This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
BFM 89.9, you're listening to Bar None, the sports show that aims to inspire, motivate, and bring out the sporty side of you. I'm Audrey Raj. Our power in the house this week is Eric Rush, a Rugby World Cup Sevens champion with New Zealand, a double Commonwealth gold medalist, and one of the few in the world recognised as a fair rugby player.
One of the things my dad said was, your great-great-great-grandchildren won't remember how much money you had, but they'll always remember if you make the All Blacks.
Next, get on the ball and up to date with Jason Lim and I as we look back at Brazil's 7-1 mauling by Germany at the World Cup this week and some of the heaviest defeats in the tournament over the past years.
One down, two down, they were like, okay, Brazil's going to come back, Brazil's going to come back. Then every time Germany touches, they score. They were throwing beer, they were throwing stuff on the field. They just couldn't believe it.
And finally, find out how you can steal time to play with sports bandits. Rezan Majid lets us in on a sports league aimed at bringing young urban professionals together through team sports and social events.
Where it differs from a lot of other things that are going on is that we're incorporating the social side with the sports side, trying to bring that community together.
BFM 89.9, you're listening to Bar None with me, Audrey Raj. Our power in the house this week is a qualified lawyer, a former All Black star, and an all-round nice guy. This New Zealand rugby star was heavily gaining traction in the mid-90s before the emergence of All Blacks legend Jonah Lomu effectively ended his fledging international career. He took this as a challenge though and later became a legend himself, leading New Zealand to gold in the 98 Commonwealth Games in Malaysia and then becoming a full-time sevens player to inspire New Zealand to many more championships. Our power in the house this week is Eric Rush.
Michael Jones, Zinzanbrook, Kilhane. Again, it's fast hands, bunts, Rush through. Beautiful run by Rush. A great try for Eric Rush.
Well, the try is really just made there by the angle that Eric Rush came at the ball. He came at a different angle, coming in between two players with a short pass, then went out again and had the pace to get there. But it was all in the timing and the angle that he came into the back line.
Eric was down recently for the British-Malaysian Chamber of Commerce Charity Rugby Coaching Clinic when we caught up with him for a quick chat. Good morning, Eric.
Morning.
So tell us a bit about yourself. How did you get started in rugby?
Oh, New Zealand is a country that rugby is our national game. So it's just part of growing up in New Zealand. So I started playing rugby when I was five. I've got one daughter and four sons, and all my sons started playing rugby when they were five. It's just a bit of what we do in New Zealand.
Okay, so tell us a bit about the call-up for your first international test. I mean, the first time you ever played for the All Blacks, what was that like?
Well, there's two different teams. There's the Sevens team, which plays in Hong Kong every year, and we played here in 1998 at the Commonwealth Games. I made that team as a 20-year-old. Like in 1988 or something like that. Then the All Blacks 15-a-side team is the team that people know around the world. And I got called in as an injury replacement. It was a funny story actually, because they came into our room about 3 o'clock in the morning and woke up the wrong bloke.
Oh.
And told him he was in the All Blacks. They only realised when they turned the light on that they were meant to have told me. So.
Oh my!
Yeah, so I felt a bit sorry for my roommate, but...
Stroke of luck, though.
Yeah. I felt sorry for him for about half a second, and then I was happy.
Of course, but the first time ever playing for the 15-a-side, what was that like?
Oh, dream come true. You know, in New Zealand, as I said, it's a national sport. Growing up, you dream of running out onto a rugby field with a black jersey on, singing the national anthem, doing the haka, and you know the. You can't wait for that game to start because you feel 10 foot tall and bulletproof, and you had all the families there. And you know, as my dad said, because I was going to go to Japan to take a big rugby contract before I made the All Blacks. And one of the things my dad said was, your great-great-great-grandchildren won't remember how much money you had, but they'll always remember if you make the All Blacks. So, yeah, so, and that's what it's like playing in our country. You know, you make the All Blacks, and it's funny though, because you're forever known as former All Black.
Yes.
Yeah, I'm starting to think that's my first name now, because it precedes every article that's in the paper now. It's former All Black. But that's how seriously we take rugby in our country.
So now you were part of the team that won the gold right here in Kuala Lumpur during the 98 Commonwealth Games, and then again 4 years later in Manchester. How was competing in these games?
Oh, this is the Commonwealth Games is way different, because it's one of my best rugby memories is the KL tournament, because the Commonwealth Games is not just rugby. We were just a small part of a big team. And we came in and we were new boys on the block, never been to a games village. And all the teams that were around and all the different athletes, and we were getting photos with all the big swimming stars, and I think the cricket guys were here at that time, and the Jamaican sprinters. And it was just a real, real buzz. And it was a lot of pressure, because New Zealand hadn't won any gold medals, or any medals in fact. And the whole team was saying, oh, the rugby boys will win. Well, sevens ain't that easy. And when you're playing in this humidity and this heat, and then it always rained at 3 or 4 o'clock in the afternoon, man, it was tough. But we got through it, and to stand on the medal dais and get a gold medal put around your neck and watch your flag go up the mast and sing your national anthem, it was pretty, pretty inspiring. And one of my most favorite rugby memories. We thank the Malaysian team quite a bit for that gold medal, because they actually beat us in the warm-up game. We got here from Singapore. It was hot down there, but it seemed even worse up here.
Yeah.
And we played them in a warm-up game the day after we arrived, and they beat us because they were running around like it was nothing, and we just struggled. We couldn't run at all. And that losing that warm-up game made us go to the next level. And I think that's probably the biggest reason we won the gold medal.
Is the reception from fans in New Zealand any different to these events, these games, to a win compared to, say, a usual rugby tournament?
It is different, because Commonwealth Games is, like I said, it's not just a rugby event, it's a sporting event. And, I feel pretty envious of the guys who are going to the Olympics now, because winning a Commonwealth Games gold medal was special. But I think that the Olympics must be another step up, because you're Olympian, and that's a special title in itself. Not so different for the rugby guys, because I think the only major team that doesn't play the Commonwealth Games is the French. And, they're one of the rugby powers, but with all the other teams coming in with China and the US, and they're only getting better and better, so it's going to be a great experience for those guys. Back to your question, I think the New Zealand rugby public, they expect the All Blacks to win. And that's a lot of pressure, but it's also a big part of the reason why the team is such a successful team, because the expectation is to win. There's no plan B. We don't even discuss plan B. If you lose when you're in a New Zealand team, you don't want to go home.
Oh, I can imagine. So coming back to you, this is a tough one. Some say the emergence of Jonah Lomu effectively ended your All Blacks career. Yes, he impressed when he came onto the scene, but did this really push you out of the squad? What happened there?
Oh, no, I played 30 games for the All Blacks, 30 more games than I ever thought I would play, because I actually never made rep teams when I was a young fella. I wasn't quite good enough. And Zinzan Brook I played the same position as Zinzan Brook when we were kids, because we grew up in the same area. So Zinny always made the teams anyway, so I was quite used to missing out. And I only made the rep team when I was 21. And then when I made the All Blacks, there was John Kern and Inga Tuigomala and John Timu. They were the incumbents. So I got the games now and then. And then Jonah and Jeff Wilson and Christian Cullen came along. And so I always struggled for game time. But to me, that I wasn't too fussed about that, because I was playing games that I never thought I'd play anyway. But Jonah was a freak of nature. And, I had the pleasure of playing with him a lot of times as well, and we were pretty tight as friends. And so I don't like to look at it as he ended my career. I was just glad I was in the same era and got to play with him and watch him play.
So rugby sevens, you sort of made it your thing. And what are the challenges associated with playing the short game compared to 15-a-side?
Obviously the fitness is a different level. Not too many 15-a-side players can come across the sevens, because it is a totally different ball game. There's very little room to hide when you're out on the sevens paddock, and you soon get shown up if you're not up to speed. That's the biggest challenge. The other thing is teams like Malaysia and Japan and Sri Lanka, if you let them have a good start, you can lose, you know. And Japan and Sri Lanka and Malaysia, there'll be a long time coming before they beat the All Blacks in 15-a-side. But it's always a possibility when you're playing sevens. It's what I hated about sevens, but it's what I also loved about it as well, because anyone can get out there and compete.
You went on to help New Zealand win the first six versions of the World Seven Series. Great success there, but what would you say has been the highlight of your career?
I think the first Commonwealth Games medal, you know, it was just a huge thrill. And, you know, we had a, you know, team full of stars with Jonah and Christian Cullen, and even they talk fondly about that particular tournament because it was such a hard tournament. And it was, you know, first time I'd been to Malaysia and the Commonwealth Games, and I was surprised how many Malaysian people support the All Blacks, you know. Everywhere we looked there were All Black flags, and it felt like we were playing at home when we were in the final. And that doesn't usually happen for the All Blacks. Usually we're the team that everyone loves to hate.
but the All Blacks are the second team for Malaysians here.
Yeah, well, we picked that up pretty quickly, and every single one of them knew who Jonah was. So I was the official photographer.
Oh! Yeah,
so everywhere we went, I was taking photos of Jonah with all the Malaysian people. I think that's why we enjoyed the tournament so much, is because we had great following at the stadium and around the Gaines Village and everywhere we went in town. So it is a special. To me, that's the highlight.
Now, you are regarded as one of the most pacey and skillful wingers in rugby. Motivation and mental preparation must play a big role in your skills. Now, how do you keep yourself motivated ahead of tournaments?
To me, I was, like I said, I never made rep teams when I was young, and it took me till I was 21. And when I got there, I wanted to stay there as long as I could. So I never took the big offers to go to Japan and France and England. I wanted to stay and play in a black jersey for as long as I could. And to do that, I had to stay ahead of all the young guys, because I was 39 when I finished playing for New Zealand. And my roommate, when I finished, he was 17. So he was 2 when I first represented New Zealand. So,
oh, if you put it that way.
Yeah. I think that actually made me sort of think, hey, mate, I'm about time to hand over the reins here. But I always thought when I was getting on in years that if I wanted to keep up with the young guys, I needed to train harder and smarter. And I always thought, you know, Sunday mornings, and it's, you're a bit sore from the day before, played a game of rugby or whatever it was, you always pictured the young guy. What would he be doing? And I knew for a fact that most of them would be lying in bed on a Sunday morning. So that would make me get up and go for a run. So that's how I kept ahead of the pace for as long as I did. Well, I hope I did.
And the mind games, the haka usually helps, but what else can you do to get a one-up on your competitor?
We always try to make it personal because, you know, fair play and all that stuff, that's really good. You know, it's all that stuff. It's all about playing the game, all that. But at the top level, it's about getting it physically over your opposition. And to do that, you have to be in a certain mindset. And the haka wasn't really not used for us to psych ourselves up to play the game. If you needed a haka to do that, well, you shouldn't be there. It was all before that. The haka was more of a, nowadays it's more of a respect thing. It's a respect you show to the opposition, because it's something that we don't do all the time. It's only when in special occasions. That's why the All Blacks, test for the All Blacks is a special occasion, so they will do it every time. For us, we played 6 games a weekend, so we only did it if we won, and that was the sevens way of doing it. So it was a respect to the people who came to watch, the opposition. And you know, in the old days when they did the haka, they did it before they went into battle, but you were allowed to eat those people afterwards too. You know? So you're not allowed to do that obviously anymore, but so I've had a couple of Aussie mates who say that the haka gives us an unfair advantage. Well, same thing. If you get scared by a whole lot of fellas doing a dance before the game, you shouldn't be there either, you know. And I don't know if it's an unfair advantage. The Aussies sing Waltzing Matilda before they play the test. I think that's a pretty scary song. Especially the way some of those tight forwards sing.
Okay, you said something about fairness back there. You were voted best and fairest player at the 91 Hong Kong Sevens. How does one strive to play fair, that in a rough and tactical game like rugby?
No rugby player should ever win a fair play award, if you ask me, but because it's just not that type of game. But there are ways to, I guess just respecting the opposition, it's more about that. And for us, we respect the opposition by playing as hard as we can against them. And if it means whacking them in tackles, and that's what you got to do. But I think the best and fairest probably is a bit of a oxymoron when it comes to playing rugby, to be fair.
Have you retired from rugby now for almost 9 years?
Yeah.
And are currently part of the coaching lineup for the New Zealand Sevens. What's the next step? Is coaching somewhere in the future?
Yeah, I'm actually not officially involved with the Sevens team. I just go down to the camps every now and then. They've got a camp coming up for the Commonwealth Games next week, I think, so I'll go down and have a look. Gordon Titchens likes to keep me involved. And I keep an eye out for players around the country because, there is a lot of talent in rugby in our country. So he can't see everything. So that's my job really, is to try and spot these young fellas and give them a heads up. And I guess I'm lucky he trusts my judgment because we think pretty similar because we were together for a fair amount of time, I guess.
So just before we close, any advice for budding rugby enthusiasts here in Malaysia?
Yeah, I think rugby is the game where you play for enjoyment first and foremost. But if you do get to the next level, the training is what makes a difference. You know, you can't just turn up to your team trainings and expect to make it to the Hong Kong Sevens for Malaysia or the Commonwealth Games. The stuff you do by yourself, away from the big crowds and the cameras and the reporters.
Like the Sunday morning runs.
The Sunday morning runs when no one's watching and no one cares. Those are the times where you separate yourself out from the others.
Thank you very much for your time. It's been a pleasure. I've been speaking with former All Black star, double Commonwealth gold medalist and rugby sevens champ with New Zealand, Eric Rush, as our Power in the House this week. This is Audrey Raj for BFM 89.9. Coming up, get on the ball and up to date as we look back at some of the heaviest defeats at the FIFA World Cup. BFM 89.9.
As well, and he goes back, toss it in, and Germany lead Muller. It's found its way through Fernandinho to Tony Kroos here. Kroos through the legs back into Muller. Muller, closer, brilliant save, closer scores. Historic goal, Germany 2, Brazil 0. Lahm in all kinds of space. Lahm, Muller through Muller, could be embarrassing. It's 3, Tony Kroos. It could be 4, it's turned square, Kroos. It's 4-0 to Germany. It might be through again here. Khedira, 5-0. 5-0. And it's a tap-in, and Andre Schürrle makes it 6 to Germany. Schürrle, oh! Andre Schürrle, it's 7. Oscar for Brazil gets 1. And that's it. And Germany are into the World Cup final. It is finished in Belo Horizonte. The most surprising scoreline, Brazil 1, Germany 7.
BFM 89.9, this is On The Ball on Bar None, where we discuss some of the interesting picks from the world of sport over the week. Jason Lim joins me in the studio once again.
Good morning, Audrey. Always a pleasure.
All right, Jason. So this week, the world witnessed one of the most painful matches of the World Cup. Painful, not only because of the scoreline, but because of the visible agony on the faces of Brazilian players on the pitch, those in the stands, and fans across the world.
And they called it a national tragedy, and that's when Germany, of course, whipped Brazil 7-1, crashing the hosts out, who self-proclaimed themselves to be the World Cup winners.
Yes, the heir to the World Cup throne.
One down, two down, they were like, okay, Brazil's going to come back. Then every time Germany touches, they score. They were throwing beer, they were throwing stuff on the field. They just couldn't believe it.
I don't know, there isn't words to explain a match like that.
I'm almost speechless, you know, I've never seen Germany ruling a game like that. 7 goals speaks for itself.
This was the biggest loss of this year's edition of the World Cup, eclipsing the defending champions Spain's early stage group loss of 5-1 to Holland.
Yes, but was it the biggest blowout in World Cup history, 7-1?
Surprisingly, Audrey, it is not. Far from it, in fact. There were a couple of unbelievable thrashings in past tournaments. Some of them sound more like rugby or cricket scores than a scoreline from a football match. Like this one from the 1950 World Cup, also in Brazil.
It was all too easy for Uruguay, who were placed in the only two-team group with Bolivia. For the Sky Blues, things got off to a cracking start. Miguez opened up the scoring in the 14th minute. Vidal made it two in the 18th, followed by a third from Schiaffino in the 23rd minute. The first half ended 4-0 when Miguez got another. He scored again as the second half got underway, and in the 59th minute, Schiaffino made it 6-0. Perez followed with the seventh goal of the match in the 73rd minute, after Guija scored in the 83rd on a great ball in by Schiaffino.
That match between Uruguay and Bolivia ended 8-0. So kasihan.
A lot of us might not remember all these old matches. For example, the 1954 game between Hungary and South Korea ended 9-0.
9-0.
Yeah, the Hungarians, of course, were the best team in the world at the time. But there was a lot of background to it, because there was a lot of political tension because of the Korean War, which pitted the US-backed South Korea against Soviet-backed North Korea. And Hungary, of course, was under Soviet control, so it was like a proxy, right?
Right.
And because of this, the match was seen like a proxy battle between the Soviet Union and the US.
It was also Hungary that demolished El Salvador in the 1982 World Cup. This match, however, wasn't so fair, because Hungary was one of the best teams at that time, and El Salvador's players were all managers due to various unrelated circumstances. Some of their players apparently couldn't play, and they didn't even have track suits. A lot of issues, so the managers ended up playing.
Well, talk about amateur hour.
Yes, it didn't come as a shock when El Salvador were thrashed 10-1 by Hungary. But given the incredible circumstances, though, the fact that the team scored one goal, those managers, not bad, but...
Yeah, it reminds me of Oscar's last goal for Brazil against Germany. Yeah.
That's the consolation. And more recently, however, it was Germany again who scored 8 goals against Saudi Arabia in the 2002 World Cup match. That was the opening match in South Korea and Japan. That match ended 8-0 with Miroslav Klose. He hit a treble in that one.
Yeah, and as you know, his goal against Brazil was his 16th, and it basically broke the World Cup scoring record.
All-time World Cup scoring record.
And of course, at the last World Cup in South Africa, Portugal had a huge win. They beat North Korea 7-0. I think Raul Meireles, Simão, Hugo Almeida, Thiago Mendes and Cristiano Ronaldo finishing on the score sheet, nearly the whole team.
Speaking of goals, the most goals scored in a World Cup match, however, now this goes to Australia. Okay, they played American Samoa, but this was a qualifying match. It wasn't a World Cup final match per se, but it was a qualifier that finished 31-0 to Australia. Now, there's one striker, Archie Thompson. He alone scored 13 goals in that match.
Yeah, I mean, 13 goals is like the World Cup record for one tournament by Jules Fontaine in 1958, right?
Whoa.
So, and this guy scored 13 goals in one game. And that game, if you remember, brought up a lot of issues on whether weaker teams should be allowed to play in World Cup qualifying at all.
Oh, okay, that's interesting. But you know what? Just looking back, this is not a World Cup match, but the biggest football blowout in history to ever happen. This happened in Madagascar in the year 2002.
They play football in Madagascar? I didn't know that.
Apparently, there are a lot of referee issues in Madagascar, because this match between Adima and So Emreen, I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing this right, it ended 149-0 to AS Adima, with all goals in the match being own goals because the players wanted to protest biased refereeing.
Well, I mean, there are better ways to protest. Maybe like scoring a few for yourself, I don't know. But that's an amazing score, 149-0.
Yes, that literally is a cricket score.
Yeah.
For like a 2020 match.
So looking back, maybe 7-1 wasn't so bad for Brazil?
Maybe it wasn't, but you know, it was the biggest defeat ever for the Brazil team.
Yeah. And well, the final is coming up, and it's going to be Argentina against Germany.
Yes.
And I expect a much tighter match, of course.
Yeah, hopefully definitely more closely contested. We're looking forward to that. So that wraps up On The Ball for this week. Thank you, Jason Lim, for joining me.
Thank you, Audrey. Pleasure as always.
Next up on Because We Can, find out how you can join the new sports initiative called Sports Bandits, a social sports community for all skills and levels. BFM 89.9.
BFM 89.9, we're on to our final segment of Bar None. I'm Angeline Tay, and this week's Because We Can, we're exploring a social sports community. If your daily routine sounds like this... Probably wouldn't have time left to organize any team sports. I went around and asked some of the BFMers on how consistently they play sports.
Okay, so I enjoy badminton and bowling. I try to go about once a week, but it ends up being maybe twice in a month.
I used to play taekwondo as a kid. My parents thought it would be a good sport to put, you know, to focus my energy on, you know.
I was a squash player, reserve player last time in my high school days, and I played ping pong as well, which I enjoyed a lot.
Okay, I prefer futsal for if there's more than 5 players, so like futsal you need about 10. And I've just picked up road cycling specifically.
Team sports are quite hard to organize in a way because, you know, you need a group of people. So right now, I kind of enjoy, you know, jogging and just going to the gym myself.
I think it's the conflicting schedules with me and my friends when we want to organize the games, or maybe we just don't have time, or we're just lazy. It's always something. There's always a reason not to go.
The reason why I picked up cycling is because I was getting a bit frustrated with futsal, because with futsal you need at least 10 people in order to play, and it is very tough to find 10 people who are at your same level of playing.
Well, I used to join them once or twice a week, and the men are too good in badminton. I can't keep up with their pace, and the ladies just don't want to play. They rather watch TV.
Fret not, with us today is Rezhan Majid to tell us more about Sports Bandits.
My name's Rezhan Majid. I'm co-founder of Sports Bandits and Stat Sports League. Sports Bandits is a newly launched social sports community here in KL. And where it differs from a lot of other things that are going on is that we're incorporating the social side with the sports side, trying to bring that community together. And again, this is sort of for the working professionals in KL and some of the young adults that don't have the opportunity so much, or maybe the access to team sports and, you know, recreation, a healthy, fun way to kind of get to know people and also have a good time.
Knowing our KL lifestyle here, sports isn't something we do instinctively. I was just wondering, the food that we eat, the things that we do for leisure actually affects our view about fitness.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think the lifestyle is part of it. I mean, I think everyone kind of thinks they don't have enough time to prioritize these kind of things. I mean, health they don't prioritize, and also the social life. But we also know that work-life balance is very important. Everyone's trying to do that, so we're trying to make that easier for them. Number one, I think also is that venues and accessibility is difficult for people. So we kind of take that problem away. We set up the venues. I mean, we work in conjunction with multiple venues. We set up the games. We have an online portal where you go online and check out the games that are available for the week, the number of people that are registered for that game. And again, we have multiple sports going on during the course of the week itself. So it's just a matter of, you know, putting that time and energy into wanting to do this and prioritizing it for yourself. And we give you the solution for that, essentially.
So how can people join the sport?
You can check out our website. It's www.sportsbandits.com. You can register there, and from there, basically, you'll get an email for the membership program. And again, once you're a member, you go online, you get to see the full range of games that are going on, the venues that they're going on at, and as the facilitators of those sports, we'll be there to make sure, you know, everyone has equal playing time, you know, making sure everyone knows the rules, you know, and this is for everyone of all skill levels. So if you want to come play volleyball one week and you've never played volleyball before, and you want to meet new people playing volleyball, you know, we'll have people that know how to play volleyball, we'll have the equipment there, you know, the venues will be nice. It'll be we're targeting all indoor venues too, just as a start. kind of more private facilities as well. So there's a lot of those, you know, I feel like a lot of the solutions that we're bringing in there for people as well.
Mm-hmm. So what are the games available?
For the first intake that we're doing starting end of July and post-Ramadan will be volleyball, dodgeball, basketball, and badminton, and all are co-ed. And those will be going ongoing from then until the end of the year. But during it, we'll sprinkle in a few different sports as well for the members to try out. We've had a lot of requests for American flag football. Futsal, obviously, is a popular one. So we'll be doing those little events. And at the same time, we'll have social gatherings every month as well for all the members to get to know each other. The games that we'll be having will be located at a few different venues. We have right now Bukit Kiara Club, Garden International School, MBSA for volleyball in Jalam, as well as a couple others that are, I don't remember off the top of my head right now, but they're PJ Section 13. So all the venues are sort of centrally located within different areas. We're trying to lock down one within KL as well. But again, we're shooting for indoor facilities. Oh, we also have Sunway Extreme Park, just because they have a few venues there and that area is quite central for people as well.
So is it free to get the membership?
No, it is a 70 ringgit a month if you pay for the 6-month membership. Otherwise, if you want to try it just monthly, it's 80 ringgit a month.
And here you go. Be sure to check out sportsbandits.com to get your work-life balance right in the city. I'm Angeline Tay for Bar None.
And that's all for Bar None this week. Remember, if you're passionate about a sport or activity and want to share that excitement with us, please do. Email us at barnone@bfm.my. You can also follow us on Facebook by liking our page, facebook.bfm/bfmbarnone. Thank you for listening. This is Audrey Raj for BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.